Okay, the scream of fear, Aaron, how is this different than the taste of fear? I'm seeing, I pulled up Scream of Fear on IMDb, but I'm seeing a poster for Taste of Fear. What's going on here? And why are we talking about this for Son of Hammerland?
Why are we talking about Scream / Taste of Fear? Well, because it marks a very kind of important chapter in Hammer that is a deviation from their usual gothic output. In that it posits it's the first one of their black and white thrillers, and it was successful enough, Scream of Fear, that it kind of launched a little mini chapter in the Hammer history, because they had some success with this one, and they kept kind of cranking them out. And in some ways, it was inspired by the success of Psycho in 1960. Taste of Fear came out in 1961, hard upon the heels. But then again, I mean, there were a lot of black and white thrillers that came out in the wake of Psycho. This just happens to, in my opinion, be one of the better ones. And it's certainly, I think, one of the best that Hammer ever produced. With regard to the Taste of Fear, Scream of Fear, I'm not sure why they felt the need to retitle it Scream of Fear for the U.S. audiences, unless they just thought that that would be a catchier title to have on the marquee. But it was originally released in the UK as Taste of Fear. And I think it actually, en route, it was originally titled See No Evil and then Hell Hath No Fury before they finally landed on Taste of Fear.
I definitely like Scream of Fear better because there's screaming and there's fear in this movie. I don't know much about the tasting bit.
Well, if you see the trailer for Scream of Fear is actually quite fun, and I've never seen a trailer for Taste of Fear, but the Scream of Fear, they actually show you like the audio waves of a scream, and it's pretty fun. And they have a big thing of like, you know, Susan Strasberg's screaming face, and they're like, this is the only image we can share with you. Again, that was very much inspired by Psycho's idea of please don't tell the ending to your friends, you know, the whole idea of you're in a secret club now of those who have seen Psycho versus those who have not. And I think Scream of Fear was kind of following suit with that.
Yeah, I just imagine like the whole sound wave thing is like, it's not just horror, it's science. we can quantify the fear.
That's right. It's such a lot of fear. So much fear. You can taste it. Thank you.
No.
I'm sorry you didn't get to that one first.
I appreciate it, though. Someone's got to pick up because I'm not drinking coffee, as we've established.
That's right.
That off mic for those who care to know. This is the first podcast I've done in years where I'm not actually drinking something like water or coffee. So I'm a bit loopy.
J&B behind you.
Still yet to be cracked open. Waiting for that special occasion.
This could be it. This could be the moment.
So you responded to this movie, I guess. Like what? I take it you've seen. Well, no. I've got questions.
You responded to this movie, I guess. So, I mean, anyway, what?
You mentioned that there are a lot of kind of thrillers in the wake of Psycho, copycats. You know, that's something, you know, standard in the genre, I guess. What stands out about this one? Why did this grab you? Is it because it's that uniqueness to Hammer Studios, or is it something just intrinsic in the story itself, or is it both? Like, why this one? Why did this call to you?
So specifically this one called to me, you know, when we were talking about like what we wanted to do for Son of Hammerland, I felt like this was an important chapter to examine. And again, I think it's the first, I think it's the best. I remember I came across this simply because I was a Hammer fan and I'd gone through the gothics and I was like, well, what else do you have? And this one was kind of the top of the heap in a lot of critics and fans' estimation. So I checked it out and I just love, I love the twist, but I also love the atmosphere. I feel like after years of watching relatively sedate camera work in the gothics that Hammer does, many of them directed by Terence Fisher, that this was such a dynamic change. Like Seth Holt and Douglas Slocum, the cinematographer, Seth Holt, the director, they really move the camera. They track it up and down. They're in people's faces. They cut. It's a really exciting means of storytelling. So that was one of the reasons that it resonated with me. That I also just, I love the twist ending that you couldn't possibly guess. You know, it's like, wait, what? Okay.
We'll get right to that, because that's, yes, we I will. Said I have questions. I have many.
Yeah. I don't know that it would, as far as plans go, I don't know that it was a very good plan that they came up with. But anyway, we will talk further about that as we get in deeper into the podcast.
What I, you know, there's a lot about this movie I love, and some of it is kind of confounding to me. But one of the main things is that I didn't have to wait 2 minutes before the Friday the 13th reference jumped right out at me. It opens with a scene on a lake. Is it in Germany or is it supposed to be Italy? Because I know they referenced Italy earlier, but it sounded like they were, was it Switzerland? Okay.
Yeah.
There's these two gendarmes, I guess, dragging the lake. They're in a rowboat and they pull a body out, and it's a young woman who's drowned. But we see that there are other people on the sort of the beach, like other cop cars, like kind of hailing to them. And I immediately thought of the closing scene of Friday the 13th.
Yep. Yeah.
It looked exactly like that, except in black and white.
Yeah. I thought, what's funny is I thought of you and I'm like, oh, there it is. There it is. We're looking back to shore.
But no, what I had to go back and make sure my volume was on, because when the movie started up, it was completely silent except for the sound of like water, just like waves gently lapping. And that's a motif that pops up later in the film. It's because I think I'm reading that book Scored to Death, which will become very important to our forthcoming conversations, that I'm really noticing horror movie scores, and particularly when they are not scored, in moments where you think, well, you could have put some kind of a crazy big over the top violin-y thing to open up your thriller, but no, it's quiet and eerie and very lovely. And we catch up sometime after this body is dragged out of the lake with Penny, who is a wheelchair bound young lady who goes to visit her estranged father and her father's newer wife. Dad has gone missing recently, and there's this whole like idea of, well, where did he go? I thought you saw him. His car's in the garage. No, it's not. There's a servant, a chauffeur named Robert, who is very charming and yet also very suspicious. And it's like an hour 20 minute gaslighting session. Well, I should say an hour 15, until we realize who's been kind of pulling these strings all along.
Yeah.
And I love the idea of the story, and I also love the pace at times, but I still feel like this was an hour long Twilight Zone episode that went on for an hour 20.
Okay. I mean, fair enough. I find the suspenseful scenes, you know, they carry through, and I feel like, you know, what might be considered padding, I feel like it's a lot of kind of some delicious character manipulation, where you're kind of like, well, you know, I feel like we are consistently doubting everybody. We are doubting Penny. We are doubting Jane. We are doubting Robert. We're doubting Dr. Genard. You know, we're just like, who, you know, like who is telling the truth, and what are they trying to get? I think that's the other thing. It's like, you know, like what's at stake here? You know, what, and things are revealed, you know, layer by layer. And I enjoyed the ride. I hadn't seen this one in a little while, and so going back and revisiting it, I remembered, you know, most of the plot twists, but kind of this time with an eye for seeing how things are revealed. And again, it's a grand reveal. The ending is just like, whoa, okay. But I really, and again, I completely, to what I anticipate you're going to say, there's some huge leaps in logic where you're like, that's impossible, but okay.
You know, it's funny because, yeah, there are some really well done suspense scenes in here. Penny, she sees lights on and she ventures out into like this kind of a courtyard area between like the main house and the boathouse, I guess. She keeps having visions of her father, you know, either sitting upright in this darkened kind of cluttered boathouse, or in a chair and his head kind of flops over. It's very, very horrific. And there's other times when she doesn't really experience much of anything, but she'll notice these little kind of details out of place that don't kind of line up with what the people she's staying with have told her about the reality of the situation. So yeah, there is a mystery there. And I think, you know, I am also, the film in my estimation is also a victim of my having watched it way too early in the morning. So I think on a second viewing, I might, because I know where everything is going and how it all kind of wraps up, it did feel like padding, especially because there are some scenes that are sort of red herrings. Like, is this going to be scary? And there's other scenes where it's like, oh, this is terrifying.
Right.
The movie looks great. I mean, it's gorgeous. It's crisp. I picked up a double feature of this, you know, Blu-ray with another movie called Never Take Candy from a Stranger,
which is great. Okay. Never Take Sweets from a Stranger is terrific. It's not a thriller so much as it is a drama, but man, it is just great. I'm a big fan of that movie. So good, nice double feature there.
Well, it was the only way I could find the movie. Like, I couldn't find it. Well, they just
Mill Creek put out a 20 film Hammer box set. I think it's called The Ultimate Collection. You can find it on Amazon or other places if you don't shop Amazon, like I don't. Jeff Bezos, you have enough buy money. Thank you. But anyway, but it is a really great bargain. And on that 20 film collection, there's a lot of kind of these under the radar. I think Don't Take Sweets from a Stranger on there as well. Scream of Fear, a lot of like underrated films that you don't see popping up elsewhere. So I think it's a worthwhile investment for those who are seeking it out, seeking to dig a little deeper into the Hammer canon.
Well, especially for us when we do next year, Grandson of Hammerland, I guess, right, or whatever it's going to be. But
Grand Uncle, the first, second cousin.
It's. Tell me about the Penny Appleby, played by Susan Strasberg, who you mentioned.
Right.
I don't know if I've seen her in other stuff before. I thought she was really great, a terrific, you know, presence in this movie. And it reminded me of some discussions I've had lately, particularly with Mark Krawcheck on the Spoiler Room, about modern films and how people are constantly amazed by like strong female characters in movies. And I'm working on this. I have a working thesis. It's by no means perfect or definitive, but I feel like a lot of people who are writing these kind of think pieces were born 20 years ago. So they came up in a culture that has been constantly saying there's never been strong female characters in movies.
Sure.
But I'm constantly going back to these older films. And the further back I go, the more of these really great parts emerge. And they're not damsels in distress. I mean, the scene between her and Dr. Gerard, and we'll get to Christopher Lee in a moment, where he's talking about her, you know, condition, and she, you know, he's like kind of like a poor little girl, it'll be fine. And she kind of snaps back with like, I know more about my body and science than you do, is just really phenomenal. I think the highlight of the film, aside from that daffy, weird, like I call it a triple twist ending, is the reason to watch this, really.
Yeah, I agree. And the thing is, like, I mean, Penny certainly starts off kind of as the quavering, wounded bird. And I know what my wife and I were watching it, and she was kind of like, oh God, she's just going to whine through the whole movie. But then she really does show some spine, some steel, especially in that confrontation scene. And she's really, you know, kind of great about setting boundaries, you know, like Jane, the stepmother, you know, tries to kind of comfort, et cetera. And she's really like, no, I'm good. Stop. And, you know, it's as opposed to just watching her being like mown over, like we've seen in other horror films where you're like, come on, just stand up for a second. Like,
well, she actually has... that'd be a little bit hard for Penny, unfortunately.
Or see, maybe that's right in line with my, when Ronald literally picks her up at the airport. Could you pick me up? No, really, I need you to pick me up. So just kind of a little bit of the backstory on this one. Jimmy Sangster, who, you know, wrote a lot of the adaptations for Hammer's, you know, golden years. He wrote the adaptation for Curse of Frankenstein, for Dracula, for The Mummy, etc. And Sangster at this time, he kind of had the golden handcuffs on. Except for it was Hammer, so they were cheap. So they were kind of like, you know, tin handcuffs. But he was looking to kind of break out of, he'd written a movie called The Trollenberg Terror, which was released in the U.S. as The Crawling Eye. And part of the campaign was written by Jimmy Frankenstein Sangster. And he's like, oh dear, you know, I realize that I'm being identified as a certain type of screenwriter right now. So he wanted to write something different. And he wrote this script on spec. And he shopped it around to various British studios, not Hammer. And he ended up landing at Rank Films. And the producer loved it, signed him, and then immediately died. And so Sangster like goes, oh dear. Because the brother-in-law of the guy who died was apparently not an experienced film producer. And he's like, oh, this is not going to go well. So he immediately turned to Michael Carreras over at Hammer and said, hey, do you want to look at his script? And Michael Carreras ended up buying the script back from Rank to produce at Hammer. So even though Sangster was looking to do something different outside of Hammer, he ended up back at Hammer, but he still got to do something different. And again, this I think this kind of opened up a few more doors for him in that he was able to show that he was able to do more than just kind of recycle Universal classics.
Well, it's also, you know, kind of refreshing that it is a modern movie. It's not right. like this Gothic set piece, but it still has that same, you know, I guess kind of atmosphere, that feel, you know, correct. You feel like you're slipping into this other world that you really would like to visit and experience and live in. It's not the set decorated to hell, you know, Dr. Frankenstein's lab or anything like that, or Dracula's right. castle, but it is, I mean, I assume there was a production designer on it, but it all looked like just somebody's house that they found with a really great location.
Well, it's funny you say that, because it was Bernard Robinson who did all of those decked out to hell Gothic films as well. But in this case, because it was shot in black and white, he actually had a little bit more the whole film had a little bit more budget to play with because it was black and white. So they were able to do location shooting, which we, you know, we rarely see them do anything outside of like Bray Park. So they were able to do some location shooting. Again, they were able to do some more intricate cinematography. They were able to build a pool set piece, which is kind of integral to the plot. So Bernard Robinson was able to kind of flex his muscles in a different way as well, to do a realistic setting as opposed to just building another castle or crypt.
Let me ask you about realism, because you brought up that pool.
Yeah. you mean the TARDIS pool?
I don't know what was going on. I like the idea of the pool, though swimming in it would be terrifying, because it seems right. like at first there's I thought it was just a rectangular like fountain, like a base of a fountain. Like, right. oh no, that's a swimming pool, because there's a lot of this film that's hard to see because yeah. it's shot in the dark. It's not, you know, it's almost natural lighting because you really have to struggle even in high def. You're like, what am I looking at here? And that kind of right. adds to the tension. But, you know, Robert later in the movie goes diving into the pool because Penny says that she saw something or she had an inkling. And he goes down there and he kind of swims around and he comes back up and he's like, there's nothing. And then he gets, I don't know, he doesn't get dragged down, but he's almost like, wait a second, there's an entire cavernous dimension to this thing that I spotted out of the corner of my eye. I'm going to back down and have a look. And he, yeah, the TARDIS is the great way to describe it, because I don't know where the hell he goes.
Yeah.
But he goes there.
I was like, wait a minute, I can see the entire pool in the frame right now. And he's like looking off in the distance at, I mean,
there's I think seaweed and stuff in there.
Yeah. It's like, wow, that's quite a pool you have there. Quite a water feature. Yeah. You spoke about the lighting. Douglas Slocum, who, you know, he was the DP on this one. He did the Indiana Jones trilogy. He did Rollerball. He did, you know, he's connected to a lot of really great films. And I feel like this is kind of showing off a different side of him as well. You know, we haven't seen that kind of sharp, edged black and white. We think of, you know, a little bit more robust and colorful. But yeah. I really love the look of this film. You were talking about Susan Strasberg. I really like the performances. I like a lot of the ambiguity that it kind of runs throughout it.
I do too. I guess, I don't know. I feel like there's a lot to talk about here, but there's not a whole lot to talk about in terms of the plot, because it's not a long movie. It's like 80 minutes.
That's right.
And a lot of what happens are things that we've already kind of discussed. You know, exploring around this house, talking to people, lots of conversations. I mean, we'll get to the twist in a minute, but one thing I want to discuss is Penny and Robert kind of develop a relationship beyond just like, hey, I'm going to help you get around. And at one point they're on these rocks, you know, overlooking this, you know, ocean or whatever. And they start kissing. And then we see that the wheelchair is perched, you know, high above, almost like it's sitting on the cliff above the cliff. And it's watching them like, that's an odd shot. And it's really cool looking. What's going on here? And a second later, it whip pans over to see Jane, the mother-in-law, watching the two of them like, oh, this is very interesting. But it's not something that I expected to see here. It almost felt like a special effect the way it was set up, because in a good way, it took me out of the movie. I'm like, how did they achieve how did they build this shot?
Right. Right. No, I agree. And I mean, and there's a little bit of, you know, when you see the movie again, there's a little bit of foreshadowing going on there as well. You're like, oh, wheelchair on the edge of the cliff. Uh-oh. yeah, there's a lot of cliffs play into this movie.
There are probably people out there watching this who have not seen Scream of Fear. And despite some of my misgivings, I highly recommend watching it.
Yes.
Because of the performances, because it looks great, because it is, as you discussed, a different view into this, the talents of the people who've been making the films we've been talking about for 2 years. But I will say, if you haven't seen Scream of Fear, pause now, come back when you have, because I got to talk about this ending. Robert goes diving into the pool, finds the old man. His body is like beautiful, like white hair, just kind of like floating upward. It's really nightmarish stuff. He comes back and says, okay, we're going to the police. And he says, I got to go get dressed. Meet me out front in 5 minutes. And I'm thinking, if they really suspect that, I don't know, Jane or the Dr. Gerard are really behind this, this is the classic slasher movie thing of like, let's split up and we'll meet. Nothing bad's going to happen. Did that bother you?
Did it bother me? No, it's such a trope that I was like, sure, of course. I'll go get the car. You can't get the car. I got to get the car. I'm not going to push you, because that'd be, you know, yeah. Why would I take you with me? I don't know. I think, you know, they were thinking impulsively.
It only works really, I think, because Penny turns out to be who she is. Cause I feel like that would be, especially someone in that vulnerable a situation. Like, if there are murderers afoot, particularly possibly two, they're going to be at an advantage if someone's discovered. But okay, so they're driving in the car, Robert's up front, Penny's in the back. All of a sudden they see Jane out in the middle of the road. He's like, oh, I gotta go talk to Jane. Pulls the car over, and then the car just doesn't really stop going, and it heads right over the cliff. And we get this wonderful shot of Penny leaning forward in the car, like over the front seat, and she sees the corpse of her father laying there decomposing. And then we hear the screams and everything, and the car goes over the cliff, and Robert and Jane are revealed to be, you know, they're basically in it for the insurance, the inheritance money of Penny's dad. I thought that was great. Mm-hmm. I thought the movie was going to stop there, and I really kind of wished it did, because by modern standards, it's, you know, we've seen this kind of reveal before, but I imagine 1961, it was still fresh enough that would have been enough. Mm. But we keep going.
Yes, we do. And I'm just like, anybody whose plan involves going over a cliff in a car and expecting to survive, that's not a good plan. That's a terrible plan. I would be taking Dr. Gerard over and be like, excuse me, wait, what? What are we doing? No, just go along with it. It'll be fine.
Well, I mean, considering that what these people all think of each other, I don't think anyone would have been bothered if, like, oh, darn, the plan didn't work out. Now I'm the only one left holding this giant bag of money,
right,
in the form of a house. But okay, so the next day, Robert and Jane, they go to the authorities. The authorities come to them, and they're kind of separated. He goes out to the scene where they're dragging the water for the car, a nice kind of rejoinder, whatever, to the opening scene of, you know, dragging the lake. And then Jane is talking to the attorney about like how this is all going to work financially. And it turns out that Penny died 3 weeks ago, the real daughter. And the only way this works is because no one in this family, in this branch of the family, has ever met her, because dad remarried. Like she, Penny had gone off to live with the mother and the sister. The sister also committed suicide. That was a nice little bit of kind of red herring business earlier on. And it calls to mind like, okay, so whose body was that in the rowboat in the beginning? Because we're not given a timestamp like 3 weeks later. It could have been the sister from several years ago. We just don't know.
Right.
I think we're led to believe that it's, you know, the real Penny, but it turns out that our Penny was the good friend of the real Penny,
Maggie.
And she kind of flipped out when Penny killed herself and decided to figure out what this whole deal was about and posed as her and came to meet the family.
Well, because this was all part of their scheme, was Ronald and James' scheme, was that they were, right?
Robert.
I'm sorry, not Ronald. Ronald is the actor. Robert and Jane. But that was part of their scheme, was they sent a letter to Penny saying, please come. And they signed it, you know, to the dad, or signed it as though the dad had sent it.
Yeah.
So they were posing as the father. Now, the father apparently hadn't told Jane or Robert that his daughter had been found. And so that was the clue for Maggie, was that, oh, well, why would he be inviting his daughter, who he knows is dead? And so she was like, okay, I'm going to, clearly something's afoot. So I can't remember when she connected with Dr. Gerard about that.
You explaining that, and again, this is because it's the first time I watched it, there's so much exposition. I mean, this makes the end of Psycho, with the doctor coming out and saying, you know, he thought he was his mother, seem like, you know, something from Sesame Street. There's so much talking and so talking around stuff, and
yes,
that this is, it makes sense now. Thank you for
connecting. Good. That is part of it. You have to kind of like go, wait, so how did this work? But that was the thing, is that they had sent this forged letter because what they were planning to do was kill the old man.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were going to drive her crazy or kill her. And either way, she doesn't get the inheritance. Not realizing, of course, that the real daughter was already dead. And Dr. Gerard, being friends with Penny's father, I can't remember his name, if he has a name.
The doctor?
No, not the doctor, her father. If he's always just referred to as her father.
I think so.
But anyway, yeah, so it is lovely and convoluted. But I think that's what I kind of like about it, is how wackadoo it is. You're like, that's some awesome coincidence you got going on there. Good thing that worked out for you.
So do we, did we ever establish why Penny committed suicide, or was that just a coincidence? Because the letter showed up, I guess, after she was already dead. She just, I guess, had some problems that she couldn't handle.
Right. And I don't know why. Well, did her mother pass away? Was that part of it?
Her sister did.
Her sister
drowned.
Right.
I have to go back and like listen to the timeline, because the sister died and she was really distraught over it. This is Maggie talking as Penny. So this is probably things that Penny told her, you know, as friends. So yeah, I guess that makes sense. I was just trying to figure out if it had all connected to this whole crazy plot, but no, it was not. It was sort of a
separate. I don't think so. I think her death was independent. One thing I wanted to kind of mention, because there's all these, I think it's great that we have like this motif of water running throughout. And I don't know of many other Hammer films that actually have a theme in this way, where water plays so heavily. I mean, it opens with the lake, and we have the swimming pool, and we have the cliffs, and, you know, they're just all of these kind of water motifs throughout, which I find really kind of fun. So the film, it's often referred to as Hammer's Psycho. But really, if you look at the inspiration, it actually goes back to 1955, which is the French film Les Diaboliques. I don't know if you've seen that one, but it's directed by Henri-Georges Clouzot. And he's the one who actually inspired Hitchcock to do Psycho, because he was like, oh man, this black and white thriller thing really paid off for Clouzot. And the writers of Les Diaboliques, who I won't even try mangling their names, but he recruited them to do his next film, which was Vertigo. So he was, and the book that Les Diaboliques is based on, apparently Clouzot beat Hitchcock to purchasing it by a matter of hours. So it's, anyway, so Les Diaboliques actually also concerns a swimming pool and a missing corpse and a very, very you can't guess the twist ending. So that, I think, is more Sangster's inspiration, as he's looking more at Les Diaboliques. And what's kind of fun, you mentioned the use of diegetic sound at the beginning where there was no score. The only music in Les Diaboliques is at the very beginning during the opening credits. There's no music for the rest of the film.
Wow.
Whereas for Scream of Fear, it's the reverse. There's no music in the beginning, and then there's music playing throughout. So it's actually kind of a fun mirror image of Les Diaboliques. But I highly recommend checking out Les Diaboliques. It's a really terrific thriller. And again, it's got another ending that you're just like, okay, didn't see that coming.
Sold. And that's the thing. There's Psycho allusions, or people could compare it to Psycho because of the time it came out, and it's black and white. And to me, the most striking resemblance between the films is the lady in the wheelchair, right. You know, kind of sitting up above everything and sort of removed, and you're never quite sure what's going on. But as far as like the twist on the twist, everybody's found out, right? Pretty much at the end. And at one point, Jane goes to confront Penny, who's sitting in the wheelchair on top of the cliffs. And they, you know, all the cards are on the table. And Jane is just kind of a mess at the end of it. And, Penny stands up in this great kind of a heroic moment. And then she ascends the cliff, like going back down towards the house. Jane sits down in the wheelchair. Like, my life is over. Little does she know, all of a sudden Robert comes in because he's figured out that he's busted, and he runs up and he thinks he's killing Penny.
Yeah, he charges the wheelchair.
Yeah, or Maggie or whoever the hell he thinks it is. He knows he's been, you know, fooled. He charges the wheelchair, kicks it over the cliff, body falls down horrifically, and he doesn't have much of a reaction. It's not, you know, he's like kind of a cold-blooded snake. I guess he has been the entire time, but there's no like, oh my God, it's the wrong person. He's like, I was going to kill somebody.
Somebody had to go.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, and you get the sense that probably Jane wasn't long for this world anyway, because he doesn't seem like the type who really needs to share. I love because you're right. He pushes it over and he just like goes, oh, when he sees Gerard and Maggie standing there, you're just like, yep, I'm caught and I messed up.
But the thing that bugs
you, yes,
when Penny reveals how she got out of that car, she's like, as the car was going over the cliff, I opened the door and got out, or rolled out. I'm like, no,
is that what she says? I thought she said that she got out after it landed, but either way, it's a ridiculous
plan. She got out
in midair like a James Bond movie.
No, I think we're meant to believe that as the car was like before it had gone airborne, she kind of like tumbled out of the side.
Okay.
I'm like, even then she would have had like scratches, bruises. She might have been in a wheelchair for real.
Sure. Right. Okay. That better than thinking that she went over the cliff and was fine, which was actually the assumption I'd been operating on. And like, that's a bad idea. You should get out of the car now.
But at the end of it, you know, when Robert realizes what he's done, you hear a voice off screen saying, Monsieur Robert, will you come with me, please?
Right.
I'm like, oh, it's the cops. They showed up and they've witnessed this horrific crime, so he's going to jail. But no, it was the doctor.
Yeah.
And Robert just kind of like ascends down the cliff back to the house and kind of like walks past the doctor. I'm like, where is he going? Right. Does the doctor have the authority to arrest him or something? I don't know.
I feel like the police were there. Are you sure it was Gerard who said?
I'm pretty sure it was him.
Okay.
Well,
I thought it was the officer who'd been questioning Robert up until that point.
Well, because there was a voice off screen.
Right.
And I was like, oh, that's probably the cop. But then when you see him walk down towards the house,
he walks past
Dr. Gerard. And I didn't notice if there were other people there, because I think I was still scratching my head. Yeah, me too.
I would have to go back and look.
But it just seemed like an off, because I know he's not getting away with this crime, but at the end, it kind of looked like he got away with the crime.
I push and I walk away. I wanted to just kind of, I realized we're running toward the end here, but I wanted to throw out some of the other titles that people might want to check out, because I think this is the only one of these thrillers that we're going to be talking about this year. And as you pointed out, I mean, this is less Psycho. There are other films like William Castle's Homicidal or Francis Ford Coppola's Dementia 13 that are much more blatantly inspired by Psycho. But some of the other black and white thrillers from Hammer, and a lot of them were actually scripted by Sangster. There was Maniac from 1963, Nightmare and Paranoiac, both from 1964. The Nanny and Hysteria, those were both 1965. And then they switched to color. They did a few more of these thrillers in color. Die, Die, My Darling, Crescendo, Straight On Till Morning, and Fear in the Night. And I think those are all worthwhile to varying degrees.
So you've seen all of them?
I have seen all of those, yeah.
Wow. I guess because we talk about genre films all the time, so I guess it's kind of the same thing as if you had just listed off, you know, a dozen slasher movies. I wouldn't have been surprised that you saw those, but I don't know. It just, are they all different enough to recommend in their own right? Because I'm like, how many twists and double crosses can you stand?
Well, there's a lot of noir and crime, and you know, it's like I feel like yes, there's enough differences between them. You're not going to confuse them. You're not going to be like, oh, that's there is that same thing again. I mean, Sangster's a, you know, he's a talented screenwriter. He does repeat himself a little bit at times, I'm sure. But I think he does enough to kind of keep them separate. And the performances are great fun. Paranoiac, and I believe Nightmare. I could be wrong. I think those both feature Oliver Reed. And they cast solid performers and good scripts, and you know, the technicians are all solid. So yeah, I'd say again, this, the whole idea of doing a spotlighting Scream of Fear is to kind of say, you know, here's another face of Hammer that perhaps you have not seen or considered, because you have an idea of what Hammer is, and this is very, you know, something else. This is like Hammer, you know, a different face of Hammer that you also might enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, similar to the, you know, Quatermass experiment.
Correct.
I set it right this time.
Good job.
Thank you. But no, one thing I don't want to brush over before we go is Ann Todd, who plays Jane.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. You know, every performance in this movie, with the exception of the doctor, because Christopher Lee he's really good, but he just doesn't get that much screen time. But
right.
There's a duality to every single character here.
Yeah.
And the whole time you're watching Jane, you're like, is she evil or is she just being misinterpreted by the, you know, daughter-in-law that she never got to know, and she's being blamed for, you know, problems in the family.
Right.
But at the very end, I'm just wondering who instigated this whole plot. This feels like Robert came to her and said, hey, I know how we can, you know, get really well, and I'll love you, baby, for a little while until you go over the cliff. Because she genuinely I felt bad for her at the end when she got caught, because she's like, I never quite meant for all of this to happen. And it's almost like this is the first time when she realized what she had done to these people.
That's a great observation. I get the sense that, yeah, it was much more Robert's idea than hers. And that he may have been scheming all along to say, okay, if I have an affair with you, and then I bump off the old man, I bump off her, make her go crazy, then, you know, you'll get the money, and then I'll bump you off, and then I'll have the money. Because it seems like he does not come from a, you know, he seems like he might have come from a lower class and is, you know, kind of like scrapping his way up. I mean, he's working as a chauffeur to this rich family. So I can see him kind of having that that desire to climb. But yeah, I think Ann Todd is terrific. I think Ronald Lewis as Robert is also quite great. 1961, he also did Mr. Sardonicus, which is a really terrific William Castle film. Have you seen that one?
No.
So they've
heard of it, but
yeah, Mr. Sardonicus, it's the gimmick for that one. Castle was famous for his gimmicks. The gimmick for that one was that toward the end of the film, William Castle himself came on screen and said, "So what do you think? What should be the fate of this character? This or this?" And the audience would hold up their sign saying, you know, should he be punished or not? And William Castle knew that the audience would be like, yes, punishment. So he never shot like an alternate ending. He's like, nope, they're all going to say punish him. And so that's the ending we'll shoot. But anyway, that's Mr. Sardonicus. And Ronald Lewis plays the one of the lead characters in Mr. Sardonicus, which came out the same year. Well worth checking out as well.
Well, that's the thing is I was not familiar, aside from Christopher Lee, with I think any of the leads in this movie. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, I was like, why don't I know these actors more? They're all really great.
So Susan Strasberg is actually the daughter of Lee Strasberg, who is one of the progenitors of the Method.
Yeah.
The Method School of Acting. And so she was kind of like, you know, acting royalty. She originated the role of the Diary of Anne Frank, or rather she originated Anne Frank in the play of
Anne Frank. Yeah,
she didn't play the diary. The role. She didn't play the diary. Oh, yeah, Anne Frank was definitely the first person to play Anne Frank. But she played it on Broadway. And then for genre fans, you can see Susan Strasberg in The Manitou and A Bloody Birthday. So she also did like episodes of Night Gallery and Tales from the Dark Side and things like that. So she has a genre stripe to her.
Do you know if the dad had worked out this whole Method thing before raising his daughter or after? Because I would be horrified to think, oh, father, I've got this lovely part coming up in a movie where I'm in a wheelchair. A wheelchair, you say?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, apparently Strasberg's wife, Susan's mother, was on set and was just a holy terror. Like she would be like, she would apparently shake her head like no, as in like that was a bad take.
To her and daughter or to other people?
To her daughter.
Oh.
And her daughter would be like, can I do another one, please? So apparently it wasn't the healthiest of relationships.
Well, that makes me appreciate the scene with the doctor at dinner even more, because I feel like she was probably talking to her mom at some point. Like she finally is standing up to an adult.
Leave me alone, mom. I'm working here. Can we talk about Christopher Lee? I mean, Christopher Lee is basically cast to be Christopher Lee, because you think, oh, well, clearly he's the bad guy because it's Christopher Lee. You know, he's basically just a red herring, and he's saddled with a questionable French accent, shall we say?
Very questionable. He felt like a Brit who was raised part-time in France.
Yeah. I love that. Like nobody else is even trying to do anything accent wise, you know, clearly, you know, mom and dad, well, clearly Susan Strasberg is American. Mm-hmm. And dad is, I mean, but like where did Robert come from? You know, you'd think you would hire a chauffeur, you know, a local.
He could be a local. Maybe he was a transplant from wherever. I mean, that's the thing.
That could be. Okay.
I don't know. The rich and famous, the world is their playground. They don't have to be from anywhere.
Damn it.
But
Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos. See, this would be my rage against, you know, capitalism right here.
Well, I gotta say, I was so convinced of the depths of Robert's evil by the end of this movie that I was thinking, how far back does this go? Did he kill the mother? Did he drown the sister and make it look like a suicide?
There you go.
Because I feel like this guy's playing the long game.
He's exactly. I'm just going to murder everybody until I get the money.
But yeah, there's no indication that that's the case, but it does, it's not outside the realm of possibility.
I like that. One more time where you come up with a better movie than the one we've just watched.
It's an addendum. but yeah, I'm glad that you recommended this. I'm glad we watched it. I'm sure that the next time I watch it, for the reasons I mentioned before, I'm going to appreciate it on a different level. I think that's all I've got to say. Anything to close out the stream?
I think Psycho, like Les Diaboliques, like Homicidal, Dementia 13, like all these movies that kind of hinge, Fight Club, things like that, where it's like, it becomes a different movie when you watch it the second time because of the twist ending. You're like, oh, wait a minute. That means X, Y, and Z all the way along. Which kind of makes, for me, it's a lot of fun to be able to watch the movie and now you're watching it from a completely different standpoint of, oh, that person is not who they say they are. They do not mean what they're saying.
Well, I just realized something I wanted to talk about for a minute or two.
Great.
Another question. Okay. So Maggie is her name, the yes. fake Penny. She's up there playing the players. She's kind of tricking them just as they are trying to trick her, but they're also trying to drive Penny insane by propping up dear old dad's corpse in different places, kind of gaslighting her. Maybe this is something I'll pick up later on, but I feel like if there wasn't in this movie, it was sort of a missed opportunity to see what that kind of terror would do to someone who was even in on the gag. Mm. Like Maggie knew she was going out there to try and expose these devious people, but even she must have had a point where she was freaking out, like, I swear I just saw a corpse.
Right.
And even having the wherewithal to say, I just saw my dad's body. Trying to keep her story straight throughout all
this ordeal. Well, here's the question. I don't know that they're actually trying to drive her crazy. What they're doing is they're creating a scenario in which she seems crazy.
Sure.
She's claiming to see things that aren't there. So, in some ways that's actually easier to do than actually driving somebody crazy, because you don't know what their, what their mental capacities are. But to be able to say, okay, you keep saying you see this dead body popping up and there's no body, and you keep saying this, and like all these things aren't really what's happening, my dear. So in that regard, to your point, yes, I think if you're rolling around and you don't expect to see somebody, but I don't think, even if I knew what had happened, I wouldn't want to be in the same room as a corpse, a watery dead corpse, watery corpse, like propped up in various, every time I turn around the corner, I'm be like, okay, there he is again. Thanks.
Well, it's partially the creep factor of seeing this body, but it's also knowing that you are in a house with people who would take the person they killed and prop up their body in different scenarios.
Yeah. Not only they're murderers, but they're sickos.
Yeah. That gets back to my whole question of like the, I'm going to go get new clothes on, meet me out front in 5 minutes. I'd be like, hell no, we are not leaving each other. But I'm unfortunately going to have to leave you, Aaron. That's Christensen.
Quite all right.
Dr. AC of Horror 101 with Dr. AC. And I'll have a link to your review of Scream of Fear down in the description below. I have not read it yet because I wanted to make sure I watched the film first. But I'll definitely check it out. And everyone else should out there as well. And check out your site and subscribe to this channel and give the thumbs up and all that good stuff. And I'm going to put you on the spot again, Aaron. Did you come prepared? Do you know what we're talking about for May?
I don't it's okay remember what we're talking about for May, but I remember it's 1962, right?
Well, so that right now it's 2022, so you're a little bit off. I'm gaslighting you.
Why do you do this to me? Here we go. The Son of Hammerland roster, as recorded by. So, this is going to be good. We're going to see Curse of the Werewolf in May.
Okay.
And you've never seen this, right?
No.
You've not seen The Hammer, Curse of War. Now, have you seen Lon Chaney's The Wolfman?
No, I've seen bits of it. This is going to be another one of those, like I think I mentioned before, the only Universal picture, like monster movie I've seen
was Dracula and Frankenstein when we watched them last year.
And before that, Bride of Frankenstein.
Got it. Right.
So, yeah.
Okay.
So this is all pretty much all new to me. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, I mean, the good news is that it's not really a remake of The Wolfman at all. It's more a remake of The Werewolf of Paris, or rather an adaptation of The Werewolf of Paris. So it's a completely different story.
Okay. Well, I haven't seen A Werewolf in Paris. I didn't even see An American Werewolf in Paris, which came out in the late 90s. Yikes. But I will see you next month, and we'll be talking about the Curse of the Werewolf?
Curse of the Werewolf, starring Oliver Reed.
Awesome. Who we name dropped early in this
episode. Just talked about.
Yeah, perfect. All right, sir. Thank you very much. And yeah, I'll catch you in a month.
Keep screaming.
How was that?
That was good.